It's the 30th of March 2012, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Would donors buying access to dinner with Cameron be more acceptable if they went to Greg's? Is it possible to tactfully interview a sex blogger? How do you make an IMAX film without the use of CGI? We won't be speaking to Michael Bay to find out. Should Alan Turing's face be on the £10 note, or should he remain an enigma? And should we ban the burqa? But first, as usual, our traditional begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then do head over to our website and make a one-off donation or subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month. All donations are greatly appreciated and really do help us keep doing this sort of thing week in, week out. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Also, we've partnered with Audible, the audiobook company. If you sign up to Audible's free trial by following the link on our website, then you can download a free audiobook. And there's loads on there from science to politics and all that sort of thing, and you can download for free. That's rather nice, isn't it? So follow that link on poddelusion.co.uk. So awkward begging out of the way, let's get on with the show. Now, we start this week with a response to something we had on the show last week. You may remember last week when Georgia Gayle Grant did a great piece on the Pray for Fabrice Muamba thing, you know, the footballer who collapsed, and she made some suggestions of some better things that we can do than what is essentially organised wishing. One of the suggestions was made that people could get screened for the condition that the footballer was suspected of having, but surprisingly, it turns out that screenings are not necessarily the best thing to do, as GP and health writer Margaret McCartney kindly volunteered to explain for us.
Last week, Georgia Gayle Grant argued that rather than praying for the recovery of Fabrice Muamba, it would be better for humanists, sceptics and atheists, if aged between 14 and 35, to get regular ECGs to make sure you're not at any known risk of sudden death. And she recommended that you get your friends or children or other relations to go too. On the first point, I agree. One study in the American Heart Journal from 2006 suggested that prayer didn't help heart bypass patients to recover better. But what's the evidence for her other suggestion? Screening a chunk of the population with an ECG, that is, an electrocardiogram, colloquially known as a heart tracing, and obtained by attaching electrodes to the limbs and chest wall. What she's suggesting is a screening test. Unfortunately, screening is messy, may be counterintuitive, and is sometimes hazardous. Screening tests are not for people with symptoms. Someone who has chest pain, for example, is not given an ECG as a screening test, but a diagnostic test. They are very different, but often confused, not just by citizens, but politicians and even healthcare professionals. But the difference is crucial. Screening is looking for disease before the person knows they have it. There's a great book by Angela Raffel and Muir Gray called Screening, Evidence and Practice. She is a public health doctor. He was the director of NHS Screening. It starts, all screening does harm. Some do good as well, and of course some do more good than harm at a reasonable cost. So what are the harms of screening? It seems so sensible, so logical. Pick up disease early, fix problems before you get complications, doesn't it? The truth is that screening is rarely so straightforward. Chapter and verse on what makes a great screening test was published by the World Health Organization by Wilson and Ewer in 1968. There's a link on my website. This document is full of clarity. For example, they decreed that screening should look for important conditions for illnesses where the natural progression of the disease was understood. Early treatment should have extra benefits compared to later treatment, and the test should be acceptable, with the risks, physical and psychological, being less than the benefits. Some screening tests come with high benefits and small risks. For example, all newborn babies in the UK are screened for the rare genetic condition PKU, phenylketonuria. If the child is diagnosed soon after birth, he or she can avoid foods containing phenylalanine and avoid the brain damage that would otherwise occur. It's a rare condition, one in 10,000 births, but because there is a good preventative treatment, avoiding certain foods, that can be recommended, it's generally thought of as a pretty good screening test. The false positive rate is about 5%, meaning that out of every 20 babies with a positive result, one is wrong. false negatives seem very uncommon. And this is why all children born in the UK have a heel prick test at about 10 days old, which includes a PKU screen. The harms are in false diagnoses, but this is minimised by retesting. And of course, the heels of all newborn babies have to be pricked with a needle to pick up the small amount of problems. But this is a validated, well-researched and audited screening test. Not every screening test on offer comes with the same balance of risks. You may have noticed the panoply of high street clinics offering health checks or adverts on TV offering CT scans as peace of mind. Or you may have had, like me, letters through the door encouraging me to attend a church hall near me for a heart tracing, cholesterol testing, ultrasound of the neck or abdominal aorta for a few hundred quid. Again, it sounds sensible, responsible, logical. Catch it early. Why would you want to be ignorant of your risks? And indeed, in the USA, where they seem to love health screenings, regular medicals drive a huge amount of testing, both on Medicaid and with doctors in the paid-for arena working to commission. But how much does any good? We have to remember those Wilson and Junger criteria. There is no point picking up a problem that you can't do something useful about. Let's take ultrasound of the carotid arteries in the neck for people who are well, as offered by many private screening clinics. The idea is that you can find vascular disease and treat it before it causes a stroke. The problem is that in order to prevent a stroke, the surgery offered is carotid endarterectomy, which corrects the narrowing. However, because the death rate from the operation is, relatively speaking, high, about 3%, the potential small drop in stroke rates achievable because of the operation doesn't provide a good risk-benefit ratio. So that's why both the UK National Screening Committee and the US Preventative Services Task Force say it does more harm than good and it's not a recommended screening test. The other problem that screening produces is to identify conditions that would never have caused a problem during that person's lifetime. One clear example is breast screening, an x-ray of the breast taken every 3 years in the UK for women from age 47. The Cochrane Review, that is an independent review on all the information on the subject, concluded that 2,000 women have to be screened for 10 years to prevent one death from breast cancer. But to get this reduction, 10 other women have to be treated with surgery, radiotherapy or chemotherapy for a breast cancer that would never have affected them in their lifetime. This is overdiagnosis, cancers diagnosed and treated, but which would never have maimed or killed. In medicine, a clear distinction between normal and abnormal doesn't always exist. One of my deep concerns is that the dilemmas and uncertainties of screening tests aren't adequately communicated to people taking them up. There's an excellent NHS resource for men considering PSA screening, for example, which explains that there is no evidence that PSA screening for prostate cancer reduces overall death rates and that treatment can result in impotence and incontinence. But we don't get the same kind of decision aid for the other screening tests the NHS offers, and I'm afraid this results in a rosy depiction of screening which is sadly illusory. So what about cardiac ECG screening? Well, there's been a lot of work on it. It's clear that ECG screening doesn't benefit adults with no symptoms. The test doesn't usefully or reliably pick up problems. For young people, contrary to the actions Georgia suggested, the National Screening Committee in the UK doesn't recommend screening. Why, there are several causes of cardiac death in this group, including abnormalities in the conduction system of the heart, for example, long QT syndrome, and heart muscle problems like the cardiomyopathies. A good screening test would pick up all these abnormalities with no false positives, and it would also mean that effective treatment was available. You would have to know that an ECG abnormality really is meaningfully abnormal. And a good test would not let abnormal hearts slip through the screening. And what do we know? Well, less than 1 in 100,000 young adults die of sudden cardiac death a year. Per 100,000 screened with an ECG, you would expect to find 300 with a cardiac problem, of whom 30 would be at risk, and of whom 0.4 would die per year. The screening would also generate at least 2,500 abnormal ECGs, possibly double that, and 150 false negatives. For children with certain cardiac abnormalities, medication can help to reduce risk, but there is no such thing as guaranteed peace of mind. Not all complications, sadly, can be prevented. The harms would include telling a large proportion of people that they had an abnormality, but the vast majority would never come to harm from it. And about half of at-risk children would not be picked up by screening, in other words, they would have false reassurance. Many other children would be medicated or told they had a potentially fatal condition when they would never have heart problems in the future. And of course, there's a cost-effectiveness argument too. Is this the best way that money can be spent to improve children's health? Like I said, screening is complicated. It comes with numerous caveats and is never a benign act. It's worth remembering too the popularity paradox. The worse a screening test is, the more false positives are generated, and the more people believe that their lives were saved, when actually, by being diagnosed wrongly, they were potentially harmed. Not helped. Screening needs science and attention to the evidence, even when it tells you things you'd rather not.
We've put links to find out more and links to buy Margaret's book, The Patient Paradox, on the Poddelusion website. Sneak previews of a spectacular space-themed movie have been showing up across the internet this week. It's called Outside In and is an IMAX film being made out of nothing but actual photos, so no computer-generated imagery has been used. Cash Farouk has been speaking to the creator of the film, Stephen Van Furen, to find out more.
Hi Stephen, thank you for talking to the Poddelusion. Can you start with a brief overview of the project, what you're doing, how it came about?
Well, in brief, I am making a film for IMAX theaters in my basement studio. And the short version of the story of how this came about is when the Cassini spacecraft arrived at Saturn, I had always expected that that would be a big global worldwide media event. And it turns out it was not. It was mostly ignored, especially here in the United States. So I decided that the reason might be that people didn't feel a sense of human connection to these robotic spacecraft journeys. So I set out to make a film that would give people the sense of flying through space as if they were astronauts themselves.
Okay. On the website for the movie, it states that this is an art film and not a science film. Can you go into that into a little more detail? Are you sort of hoping for a different audience or a wider audience?
Well, the audience for the film is very much tied to what the theme of the film, which is to inspire interest. So it definitely will appeal to people that are already interested in science and space, but I very much hope to attract people who might skip a traditional educational or science film that has facts and figures and explanations. This film is meant for people to have a personal journey, a personal guided journey, all the way from the Big Bang throughout the creation of the universe, through the course of human history, and these dramatic fly-throughs through the solar system, including the fly-through around Saturn. The idea is for people to be able to be astronauts. And that's why it was so important to me to only use real photographs in creating the film, because photographs are a way of us marking, we were there, we saw that. This is our token that we have taken back, that we put on our desk as an important milestone marker. That's what photographs serve. So by using these real photographs in space that humans have taken and allowing people to fly through them in this journey, the hope is that it will really inspire and spark people to think differently about space and space exploration.
So are you sticking just to the solar system or not? You just mentioned the Big Bang and things like that.
No, the climactic point of the film is a fly through of the Saturnian system. And the reason for that is actually threefold. One is that Saturn was always my favorite planet when I was a kid, and that's how I got interested in the whole thing. And my interest in the Cassini mission led to the film. The second reason is simply the Cassini spacecraft has taken so many wonderful photographs that enabled me to develop this high-resolution stitching technique, which makes the film possible, that it's the perfect place with its beauty and the incredible amount of photographs for the most dramatic fly-through in the film. And then there's a third little reason that Saturn is there is because one of the inspirations for this film is Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, which originally was set at Saturn, but there wasn't sufficient data for Douglas Trumbull, who was doing the special effects, so they had to move it to Jupiter. So there's a tie in that way. But the film actually starts at the Big Bang using tremendous amount of Hubble imagery. It flies all the way through the universe, through the Milky Way, and down to Earth, and then proceeds around the solar system actually a couple of times. And the film finally ends like the voyage of the astronauts, you know, looking at Earth after taking this tremendous journey.
The first one-minute sequence you released went viral. How many views are you on now?
I think it's around 4.2 million in about 250, maybe 300 countries.
Wow, and how surprised were you by this?
You know, it was, I always thought that the idea had appeal, but I had no idea how broad the appeal was. And that clip had actually been up for about 9 months before it went viral. And before that, I was like, you know, it's got a few, I think it had maybe 1,000 views before the day it went viral. I thought, well, you know, I at that time, I didn't have any idea or concept that it would be, you know, globally viewed. But I thought, well, surely this would get a little more interest. But it's just a, you know, it's just the crazy way that the internet works. So when it did go viral, it was tremendously validating that this approach of not making a narrated traditional educational documentary was really the right one, because not only did I get all the views, but I got thousands of emails and tens of thousands of comments from people all over the world talking about how deeply they responded to this, and many of them who were not the traditional science educational audience.
Yeah, the sequences really are beautiful, and it's really hard to believe they're not done with CGI. So, you know, how difficult has it been to achieve these sort of fly-through effects?
It's actually been very difficult. When I first got started, I didn't set out to make a film for IMAX theaters. It was simply going to be a 10-minute planetarium film, and I was struggling to get these techniques to work even at high definition. And Saturn's rings were the most problematic part of that, and it, you know, I tried all sorts of different approaches, and at times I thought, you know, I should just really do the CGI. This is what everybody else does. But one of the interesting things about CGI, of course, it would be much easier to do it that way, but if you know anything about 3D CGI, when you're modeling an object, you need to understand the physics of it very well. And the difficulty of a planet like Saturn is there's still a lot of argument and open-ended discussion about the optical properties of the rings or the atmosphere. So when you get into CGI modeling, it's hard to get it to look real. And then audiences, when they watch it, they know, that's not real. I can kind of keep my distance from it. So I was obsessed with using real photographs, and it took about 3.5-4 years, part of which was waiting for software to catch up so that I could use these very high resolution bitmaps in the animation to finally get it to work. But it's been very satisfying to see how people have responded to the use of real images. And yes, there are some people who insist it's got to be CGI, but enough people have been down in the basement studio and seen the raw files to go, oh yeah, that is real photographs.
So how long does it take to create each sequence? Sort of how many images are used in each sequence? How many hours are you spending so far?
You know, it really depends. Some things are very, very simple and only take a handful of images. Like the clip that's online, when you're kind of flying by moon or something like that, those sequences tend to be actually fairly simple and not that hard to do if there's just a moon and nothing in the background. When Saturn's in the background and the rings are in the background, I think I used about 30,000 different parts of different images all put together for that.
Okay, so I assume the movie will be available around the world. It's not just a U.S. thing.
That's correct. And in fact, the appeal of the film has been in some ways as strong, if not stronger, in other parts of the world than in the U.S., which is exciting for me since the film does not have narration and it's designed to have a global appeal. I already have distributors in all major areas of the world who are interested in booking the film. So the plan is for it to be seen as widely as possible.
Okay, well, we'll put links to all this on the Podillusion website for you. And thank you for speaking to us.
Well, thank you very much, Cash. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
The target release date for Outside In is mid-2013. In the meantime, you can find links on the Podillusion website to the few minutes of sequences that have already been released. I urge you to take a look. They really are stunning. This is Cash Farouk for the Podillusion.
Political party funding was back in the news this week when it emerged that if you donate enough money to the Conservative Party, the Prime Minister might just coincidentally invite you over for dinner. I'm not sure why so many people bothered. Surely it's much cheaper to go horse riding. Especially if you've borrowed the horse. Either way, though, Adam Jacobs doesn't think this ends with donations, and actually is illustrative of a wider problem for British democracy. I'm not sure what Adam is moaning about. After all, we've got the best democracy money can buy. Here's Adam Jacobs with more.
A major shitstorm erupted last weekend after a sting by the Sunday Times, in which one of their journalists posed as a potential donor to Tory party funds. The then Tory party treasurer, Peter Cruddas, who has since resigned, was filmed explaining that a donation of £250,000 would buy access to the Prime Minister and influence on government policy. Shock, horror! People who donate huge sums of money to political parties end up having influence on the party. Who knew? David Cameron's initial reaction to this was to go with his gut instinct as a politician and do what any seasoned politician would do in these circumstances. He lied through his teeth. He said that this was unacceptable and not at all how they do things. Oh no. That's bollocks, of course. It's not exactly a secret that donating large sums of money to the Tory party gets you access to the Prime Minister. In fact, the Tory party website itself advertises dinners with David Cameron as one of the perks of making large donations. But really, how much of a surprise is any of this? Surely no one is naive enough to think that people would donate £250,000 to the Tory party just for fun? Why would you donate that sort of money if you didn't expect anything in return? Well, the Labour Party were quick to get on their high horse and say how shocking it is, as if they'd ever let their funders influence them. Oh wait, didn't Ed Miliband only get elected as party leader because he was the choice of Labour's funders, the trade unions? The Labour Party MPs or members didn't want him. But hold on, I hear you cry. That's completely different. At least trade union funding of the Labour Party is based on deep historical reasons and is completely transparent. Well, maybe. But do we really think that individual wealthy donors don't also get to influence Labour Party policy? Remember Bernie Eccleston? He was the boss of Formula One Racing and donated vast sums of money to the Labour Party. When the Labour government introduced a ban on tobacco sponsorship of sporting events, amazingly, Formula One was exempt from the ban. Coincidence? I don't think so. So for the Labour Party to look shocked at this and pretend it's a party political issue is the height of hypocrisy. And let's not pretend the Lib Dems are exempt from this. The Tories let them share the chocolate hobnobs at cabinet meetings, which in percentage terms represents a gigantic contribution to Lib Dem funds. And in return, the Tories get to dictate Lib Dem policy on tuition fees, the NHS and a whole host of other things. It's not as if the latest revelations are a one-off for the Tories. Doesn't it seem a little fishy that Andrew Lansley, the health secretary, received significant donations from a private healthcare company shortly before introducing a bill that seeks to dramatically increase the role of private providers in the NHS? The fact is that, of course, donating large amounts of money to party funds buys you influence. Why would anyone do it if it didn't? The response of the mainstream media doesn't really seem to have recognised this reality. It's gone for the knee-jerk reaction of, ooh, here's a scandal, shock, horror, how terrible. And I haven't seen much attempt to look at the wider issues. Yes, many in the media have started talking about the wider issue of party political funding. Banning donations above a certain amount is back on the agenda, and rightly so. But I think there's a deeper problem that even a thorough clean-up of how parties are funded wouldn't solve. The problem is that an elite group at the top of political parties, whether or not they're influenced by outside donations, has too much power. This isn't democratic. In theory, we vote for an MP, and the MP who best represents the constituency gets to vote on the issues of the day in Parliament in accordance with the wishes of their constituency members. But it doesn't work like that in practice because of the whipping system. Most MPs vote the way their party whips tell them to. On the whole, it's not good for an MP's career to defy the whips. So we really don't get the policies of the person we voted for. We get the policies that are imposed on them by their party elite. I'm pretty sure most of the Labour MPs who were elected in 2001 weren't belligerent warmongers, but nonetheless they mostly voted to invade Iraq in 2003 because Tony Blair told them to. Many Lib Dem MPs promised before the 2010 election to vote against increasing student tuition fees, but many of them broke that promise because Nick Clegg, having presumably been bribed with some chocolate hobnobs, told them to. This isn't democratic. The Lib Dems have traditionally prided themselves on being more democratic than the other parties in the way they make policy, but they can't pretend that that's true anymore. Their recent conference voted against supporting the controversial health and social care bill, but the Lib Dem leadership told Lib Dem MPs to support the bill, and most of them did. This is not democratic, and Lib Dem voters have every right to feel thoroughly betrayed. So what we have is a system in which an elite few get to make policy, and the votes of the electorate have only a limited effect. Obviously, it's completely wrong that wealthy individuals should be able to buy influence over that policy. So if recent events push reform of party funding up the political agenda, then that will be a good thing. Personally, I'd like to see a ban on large donations to political parties just to be sure that people can't buy influence. And I'd define large fairly meanly. £500 sounds about right to me. Of course, this will leave the political parties short of money, and some will argue that they should receive taxpayer funding to make up for the shortfall. That would be a travesty. Using our money to prop up the political elite would be completely indefensible. It makes the assumption that political parties serve a public good. They don't. They serve only their own purposes. Political parties have no automatic right to exist. If they don't have a wide enough appeal that they can get the funding they need from modest subscription fees from their own members, then frankly, that's their problem. It simply reinforces the point that they don't appeal to the general public and only strengthens the argument against taxpayer funding. I hope that recent events will result in progress being made on cleaning up our political system, but please let's not fall into the trap of thinking that how parties are funded is the only problem. I have to say, however, that I'm not optimistic. Politicians have shown themselves time and again to be sleazebags. Remember Cash for Questions under the John Major government? Cash for Honours under Tony Blair? And even if your memory of those is a bit hazy, I'm sure you remember the MP's expenses scandal of 2009. But here's the problem. Although a lot of noise is made at the time of each of these scandals about how terrible it is, we still keep voting for the buggers. Although there has been the occasional success in punishing sleazebag politicians, such as when Martin Bell was elected to Parliament as an independent anti-sleaze MP in 1997, such things are incredibly rare. The fact is that millions of Labour voters continue to vote Labour no matter what Labour do, millions of Tory voters continue to vote Tory no matter what the Tories do, and Nick Clegg's mum continues to vote Lib Dem. These kind of habits are incredibly hard to break, and while they remain unbroken, I can't see any real incentive for politics to clean up its act. For a link to a web version of this piece, complete with links to some background material, please visit the Pod Delusion website. This has been Adam Jacobs, now feeling rather gloomy, for the Pod Delusion.
Now here's an awkward segue to make your stomach churn. We now move from Tories to sex. I think we all collectively shuddered then. Sean Ellis this week reports on a brief encounter he had with a sex blogger.
Yeah, I can't believe he found your mum's blog either. Here's Sean Ellis with more.
In the past few weeks, we've covered a number of issues related to women's rights and sexual freedom. But all of this has been from the point of view of reproductive rights and sexual health. So what about a bit of female sexual fun? One of the new wave of up-and-coming female sex bloggers is known as Girl on the Net. I managed to catch up with her at QED and wangled an invitation to her hotel room. This is what happened next.
First question is, can you give us just a quick potted two-sentence description of what your blog is about?
It's about shagging, and it's about why I like it and what I like, and most of it's from personal experience, and most of it's things that I've done, and guys that I've known. It's an exploration of just sort of being a pervert.
What do you get out of it?
I get lots of things. I get lovely emails from people. Men send me pictures of their genitals, which is always most welcome if anyone's listening. Women send me stories about things that they want to do. and I enjoy writing about it. If I didn't write about it, I would end up talking to people in the pub about it far too much. It's a nice outlet for talking about sex without boring all my friends to death with stories about filth.
Okay, and obviously you're doing this anonymously.
Yes.
Because you know, there are a whole bunch of people out there who would probably get the wrong end of the stick.
Yes, partly that. I have a job, which I love, so if anyone recognises my voice, please don't tell my boss. But also because, yeah, people would come up to me and assume that because I like having sex, I would definitely have sex with anyone, which is a kind of a weird assumption. I'm willing to have sex with a lot of different people, but not necessarily anyone, so I don't want to be rude to people and have to say no.
From a personal point of view, I mean, do you feel compelled to write about it? Just, or is it something that you really feel is important to do? Or is it just like a hobby thing?
It's partly a hobby, but partly... Oh, I don't want to sound really strident about it, but partly I write about it because I always thought that I was massively abnormal. And I always thought that the fact that I am a bit pervy was weird and freakish and odd, and I shouldn't be talking about this kind of stuff and doing this kind of stuff. But then when I was with one of my exes, we got really into this stuff and did loads of different things, and I met so many different people who were really into it. And it's not just men, it's women as well. And I feel like we have this such a weird assumption that men like sex and women like something other than sex. We like chocolate, we like money, we like being cuddled, we like all this kind of stuff. And, you know, everyone likes that kind of stuff. We're all just humans. Everyone likes cuddles and chocolate and money. Mm-hmm. And some of us really like sex, and some of us really like weird sex. And so why not just embrace that? So I feel like writing about it, if I can show a few people that they're not completely weird for liking that kind of stuff, then I'd be quite pleased.
I mean, when I first came across your blog, I mean, my initial reaction was, you know, oh, this is sort of male fantasy sex, you know. So just in case, are you a man?
I'm not a man.
Oh, okay.
I have had an email from someone before who emailed me saying, I'm just emailing because I think that your blog's probably written by a coven of gay men. Now, you know, leaving aside the weird collective noun for gay men, I was massively offended by the fact that someone would read my blog and go, well, obviously this has to be written by a man. It's why do we have that assumption? I say very clearly on my blog, this is, you know, this is a woman. All the pictures on my blog are me, and yet still people will not let go of the idea that the only person who can write about this particular type of filth that I'm not going to go into massive detail on, but the only person who can write about this particular type of filth is a man. Women like this stuff too. If women didn't like this stuff too, we should be worried about a society where women do it. If women hated S&M and, you know, violence and shouting at each other and having, you know, powerful, angry, passionate sex, if women hated that, then we should hate society for making women do that. Whereas actually the response is some women really, really do like it. And I would argue a lot of them.
You're getting 8,000 to 9,000 hits a month on your blog. Does that surprise you?
Yeah, yeah. A lot. I'm more surprised that women like it, which sounds massively sexist of me, but I feel like it's the sort of thing. I get emails from women saying, I really like your blog. And I feel like even though effectively what I'm writing about is female desire, it's often the sort of thing where men find it, see female desire, take it over, and then they'll give me all the comments and emails. That's lovely that guys like it as well. But yeah, I'm quite genuinely gobsmacked that people give a shit.
You know, there are a whole bunch of other blogs that we've talked about sort of offline. But the two that come up as sort of being visible to, you know, everybody are Belle de Jour and Girl on Track.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's your relationship to them? How does your blog stand in relationship to those blogs? Is it a different thing? You know, is it qualitatively different, or is it?
It's probably not as good, if I'm honest. I have a huge amount of respect for both of them. I think they're both fantastic. I feel like the mainstream has picked up on both of those and they both got book deals, which is very exciting and famous and talking about it and brilliant. But also all the crap stuff that comes with that, so being outed in the press and having to deal with all of that, which is horrible. But I think the mainstream's picked up on that and gone, oh, we found some women who talk about sex. We're done with that now. We're going to put that to one side and start looking for other different things. Whereas I kind of want to say, well, this, it's not going to go away. Women, not perhaps not all women, but I think the vast majority of women in my experience really like it. And so, I mean, this is... it's effectively just an outlet for me being kind of childishly pervy, but a few people since I've started writing have picked up on it and gone, okay, well, this is, you know, women do think this too, and yep. I find that quite flattering, and so that's what I'm going to run with.
Cool. I mean, you mentioned, you know, book deals and stuff. In an ideal world, you know, what's your next evolution? Are you just going to carry on doing the same thing, or do you want to break into the publishing business as well?
I would love a book deal. Someone wants to give me a book deal, that'd be great. No, I would love to be able to write about sex for my job. Realistically, we all have to have jobs, so that I would love for that to be my job. And I'd happily be unanonymous if that was my job. But obviously, realistically, so many people want to do that. That I read brilliant sex blogs every day. I read fantastic people who write about sex all the time, and who are honest and open about what they do. And yeah, we're all still anonymous and we're still sat at home tapping away at the keyboard waiting for a book deal. So ideally I would just like more people to read it and come and comment and occasionally send me pictures of their genitals.
Okay, so that's not something we've ever wrapped up a Pod Deletion report for. I've forgotten how to talk. So thank you very much. And
thank you.
Yeah, good luck.
Now, one of the people we seem to regularly feature on the Pod Delusion is Alan Turing. This is fairly surprising given that he's been dead for over half a century. He's an important historical figure, though. Without him, we'd all be speaking German now, and presumably, if alternative universe sci-fi has taught me anything, we'd be living in an era of steampunk and using zeppelins to travel about, and that sort of thing. So, Alan Turing was a good bloke, as we know, which is why there's a new campaign to get him on the £10 note, as Salim Fadli has been finding out.
Alan Turing is the man most credited with the invention of the modern computer. The mathematical theorems he developed underpin almost every electronic device today. They help us understand the limits of what is computable and even provide insights into the nature of intelligence. During the Second World War, he helped design machines which cracked the German secret codes at Bletchley Park, arguably shortening the war by years and saving millions of lives. I cannot think of another single individual whose contribution made this much difference. And yet, despite his achievements, he is largely unknown to the English-speaking world, except, of course, amongst computer scientists, where his work forms a big chunk of every student's first-year studies. It's obvious why Turing is not as well known as other scientists with comparable achievements. He was an out gay man in an era when to be gay was an imprisonable offence. In 1952, Turing was convicted of gross indecency and punished with a bizarre form of chemical castration. He was to be given regular injections of estrogen, the female hormone. This bizarre quack treatment was intended to decrease his libido. However, it drove him to profound depression and ultimately led to his own suicide. In February of this year, the government refused a petition to grant Turing a posthumous pardon. It was denied on the basis that Turing's actions were indeed a crime at the time. Lord Sharkey advised that we should not try to put right what cannot be put right. However, we should strive never again to return to these cruel policies. He may have a valid legal point, but it does leave us profoundly unsatisfied. And so that brings me on to a proposal by Thomas Thurman. Thomas, can you introduce yourself?
I'm a programmer. I work for a large mobile phone company working on back-end services for the handsets.
You've had an idea that you'd like to pitch to our thousands of Pod Delusion listeners. So can you hit us with it? What is your big idea?
Right. Well, the current £10 note, which has Darwin on it, is due to be replaced fairly soon. And since it's coming up to the 100th anniversary of Alan Turing's birth, I've put forward a petition to the Treasury to have Turing on the next issue of the banknote, the £10 note.
So how can you be so confident that the Bank of England will be printing a new design of £10 note?
When they release banknotes, they go in series. So currently we are mostly on series E, and the series tends to last about 10 years. And we've already had the series F for the 50 and the 20, but the 10 is still on series E.
The £10 note you're referring to is the one which currently features Charles Darwin. Now, could you live with being the man who kicked Charles Darwin off the £10 note?
Well, no, I couldn't. It would be a terrible thing to lose Darwin, but unfortunately, we have to lose Series E at some point. New security features come in and so on, and so they always redesign the notes every 10 years. It's a terrible shame to lose Darwin, but if we have to, I would rather we had Turing.
I think Turing is a fair exchange for Darwin. To me, they seem to be scientists of similar caliber importance, and I think we could definitely consider the legacy of their works. In fact, there's almost no British scientist other than Turing who can really compete with Darwin. It seems like an eminently sensible idea. But how did you come up with this idea? Give me the exact moment that it dawned on you that this is what Great Britain needs right now.
I've been thinking for a while about Turing's legacy, and it occurred to me that with the banknote reissue coming up, many people I talked to about it had never heard of Turing. Everybody uses his work every day. It's made a massive difference to everybody's life. And nobody knows, apart from computer scientists, who was behind it. And I think it's terribly sad because, you know, his story deserves to be told. And he deserves to be honored just as much as Darwin or anybody else who's been in the banknotes, or many of them more, in fact.
Yeah, I share this sentiment because, you know, I also make a living as a computer scientist, and I've studied Turing's work, and every single working day of my life, I get money because of the things that Turing invented, and I pretty much owe this one man for the food on my table and the home I live in. Arguably, the whole country we live in might have been a very different sort of place without this man and his ideas.
Yeah, I agree. I studied computer science, and I've worked my whole life as a programmer. And I've noticed over today, since the petition went up, there's been a large amount of the interest has been from other programmers who know what Turing's legacy was. But I've noticed there's also, as a bit of background, I'm bisexual myself. I've seen a large number of people from gay, lesbian, bisexual communities who also see Turing as a hero, being a great man who was also, as it happens, gay, and who have also signed on to the petition.
Thomas's petition has just passed 10,000 votes, which is one-tenth of the minimum required to get this proposal debated in the House of Commons. I'm sure that James wouldn't mind if I ask you to pause this podcast right now, go to the Pod Delusion website and follow the link on the show notes. You can sign the e-petition and then hopefully share the news on your own social networks. I can't think of a better way to ensure that we never return to the cruelty of the 1950s than to make the tragedy of Alan Turing known to everybody with a tenner in his pocket. This is Salim Fadley for The Pod Delusion.
Now, the end of the world. We're not talking about Harold Camping this time, but instead, actual ways the world could actually end. Alok Jha, who presents a little-known podcast, the Guardian Science Podcast, now I've never heard of it either, he's written a new book outlining 50 possible doomsday scenarios. To find out more about the book, and presumably how it's all going to end, James Robson had a chat with him after Hackney Skeptics in the pub.
On the 26th of March, Hackney Skeptics, organised by myself and Alice Shepherd, hosted Alok Jha at the Hackney Picture House in their wonderful upstairs venue, the Hackney Attic. Alec, the Guardian science correspondent and journalist, just released his second book, The Doomsday Handbook, 50 Ways the World Could End, and his talk was on elements found in this book. I grabbed him at the end for a brief interview for the Pod Delusion. What inspired you to write a book or this particular book about this topic?
Well, the Doomsday is one of those things which you kind of naturally people are interested in, because it's all about fire and brimstone and end of the world things, and films are full of this stuff. Great stories are full of this stuff. I mean, lots of biblical and religious texts are full of this stuff. But my thought about it was that actually, if you look through the lens of science and reason, actually there are much more poetic, I dare say beautiful, ways that the world might end than anything you could think up with just some god throwing rocks onto the earth and killing everyone because there's too much sin or something. For me, it was a way of getting into lots of scientific subjects, stretching some of them, I'll admit, but it's a way of understanding them and looking at how you come up with those scientific ideas, and then how those scientific ideas might be, you know, at their extremes, something which might end up being dangerous to us.
It's such a broad sort of section talk. You've got 50 different ways the world can end, and a lot of them people spend their whole careers working on those particular areas, those particular topics. How do you actually go about researching for a book like this? Is it you're looking at papers, are you looking at other publications, or is it, you know, getting around and talking to people?
Any and all those things, actually. For a book like this, what I did to sort of structure it was to think, here are there are sort of several dozen well talked about ends of the world, asteroid impact, say, for example. What I did was a literature review, basically. I would search for papers that looked at models of how asteroids would hit the Earth. I would look for lectures of scientists talking about them. I looked for books about these things, collected all that information together, assessed it on which papers made sense and which were crazy, hopefully got rid of the crazy ones.
No lizard people when this...
No lizard people. But, I mean, you know, you kind of want some extreme things, because some of these are examples which are on the extremes of science, but I still wanted everything to be based around science and in science. You might speculate a little bit, but I indicate where speculation is happening. I didn't want this to be a sort of wild west, we'll think of anything that can happen. Everything had to be scientifically plausible, if not possible, if you know what I mean. Lots of material out there. The way to deal with it, the way I dealt with it, was exactly the same way as I would deal with a news story or a feature, which is you look at where the sources are, collect together the good stuff, and then you find the story and shape the story from the best possible quality material. Still, sometimes, you have to think, well, it'll take some doing for this thing to be the end of the world. But then that's why I think that you have to, which is what I did was sort of try and think, what does the end of the world mean? Is it literally the world exploding, in which case probably none of these scenarios do that, apart from the sun exploding, which is going to cause us lots of problems in 5 billion years, and is the only certainty in the whole book. What we have to do is think the end of the world could be end of civilization, or the end of many nations, or structure of power changes. The world is a very pliable human concept, and so the end of your world is different to the end of someone else's world.
How have you found it in the book to kind of tackle more esoteric ideas, like you briefly spoke about strangelets?
Well, actually, for me, I had lots of fun writing about those sorts of things because they were new to me as well. So strangelets, vacuum decay, these what I would call theoretical physics ends of the universe, things that hide in the equations of theoretical physics. So they're entirely possible scientifically, but the question is, when would they ever happen? So would the vacuum which we think of as empty but actually isn't through quantum physics, if that decayed into another state, then it would obliterate everything. That's one end of the world scenario, which would be pretty bad.
Get rid of Bieber, though.
Strangelets is this thing where you have a form of matter which is so stable that if it comes near anything else, it turns that into strangelets too. And it's a science fiction idea, because Kurt Vonnegut wrote a story with something called Ice 9 in it, which was a form of such a structurally stable form of water, or ice actually, that as soon as it fell into a pool of water, the whole pool would freeze. And you know, there's a great story about how the entire planet, that all the water freezes, and you know, if you don't have liquid water, you don't have a life. So actually, those things are scientifically based. The strangelets, for example, I found them quite fun to write about, actually, because you go into basic quantum mechanics and you go into particle physics, and bizarrely, it's those things that get most interest. The stuff that actually has huge amounts of evidence and things that we could do things about, for example, climate change, which is probably our most pressing problem, if you think about it. also has lots and lots of evidence. We have lots of scientific backup for it. But it's also the thing that kind of everyone doesn't want to know too much about. And also, what are you going to say to them? The Earth is getting warmer. It's simple. The Earth is getting warmer. We need to stop putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Whereas strangely, it's this crazy thing where quarks and get together in odd ways and the entire planet could turn into a whole ball of matter that doesn't exist anywhere in the universe. And that's just much more fun as a rollicking ride to write about, actually. And actually, if you think about the coverage of things like the Large Hadron Collider and the Higgs boson and these things, it's this kind of weird end of stuff which sometimes makes some of the best stories, because it's so strange. You kind of have to say, it's going to be hard, but work with me, because the story you get out at the end of it is so fantastical that you want to immediately tell someone else. Climate change, as important as it is, you don't want to tell someone else because they either know about it already or it's so complicated you don't want to think about it. But with Strangelets, you hear that, the first thing you want to do is go, did you know there's this thing? And that's the reason to write stories like this. It's to spread this stuff. And what you're really doing is telling people about quantum mechanics, which is much more...
Which you can easily cover in a book.
Which you can easily cover in a book, that's right, yeah.
Out of your sort of 50 doomsday scenarios, which one would you choose to end the world with, if you could pick one?
I'd probably pick one that has the least pain and suffering involved, and because I have a soft spot for physics, I want to choose one which sort of sits innocently in the equations of physics, but we don't know anything about how to create it ourselves, and also something that isn't human-made, because, you know, ultimately it'd be such a shame if we killed ourselves. So I'm going to go for something like vacuum decay, which is this weird idea that the vacuum that we exist in, or the Earth exists in, might not be a real vacuum, and that at some point it could spontaneously degenerate into what's called a real vacuum, and that would mean that everything in it would just obliterate, because, you know, mass and energy and all these things are exactly the same. It would just wipe out everything, and so it would be like wiping a slate clean. This is just one of those things that has happened in the past in the universe, which as the universe has expanded. And it just shows how insignificant we actually are, because the universe just like burps and we just disappear. And probably is the, you know, least, let's say, painful, no one's fault. And really, you know, what we're going to do about it.
Thank you for that. Thank you for taking time to speak to us. And there's going to be opportunities for people to hear more from you about this particular topic in the near future.
Yeah, so I'm doing a few talks, actually. One at the Secret Garden Party about this subject, and also the Cheltenham Science Festival. That's booked in. And there are a few more sort of planned, but I think that Twitter is a good way of keeping in touch with this stuff. I'm just A-L-O-K-J-H-A. I'll sort of be tweeting about those sorts of things. If you really want to come and hear these things, then we'll be talking about them there.
For more information about future events hosted by myself and Alice, please check out pubsci.co.uk. This is James Robson, keeping an eye out for Strangelets and reporting for the Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, I thought we'd end on a nice and light, not at all controversial topic. Should we ban the burqa? It's a sentiment expressed fairly regularly by some people, but surely there's something a bit uncomfortable about the idea of banning something. In this next report, Steve Page argues that whilst the burqa is a bit unpleasant, it's not a very good solution to the deeper problems that underlie it. So in a sense, it's a bit like how George Osborne's face is unpleasant, yet really just distracts us from the deeper issues of Osborne being a massive twat. Actually, maybe the possibility of him covering up his face is actually what's stopping me from wanting to ban the burqa. Anyway, here's Steve Page with more.
When I recently attended the fabulous QED conference in Manchester, I caught Mario Namazi's talk entitled Secularism, Social Cohesion and Citizenship. I broadly agreed with the main thrust of the talk, which was that giving special privileges to religious groups is bad for society. One comment that Namazi made jarred with me, however, and that was when she said that she would like to see the burqa banned, describing it as a mobile prison. She then went on to mention that when she and her colleagues were protesting against an Islamist group, the anti-fascist UAF came down and sided with the Islamists. Namazi was quite indignant about this, but given her comment about banning the burqa, my first thought was, if you don't want anti-fascist groups to protest against you, it might be wise to avoid acting in a clumsy way that can easily be misinterpreted as totalitarian. However, as it was late in the day and I was unable to condense this thought into a coherent tweet, I ruminated on it for some time before deciding that I needed to more closely examine the instinctive discomfort I felt at the prospect of the government banning certain items of clothing, which I initially put down to my many years of woolly liberalism and my aversion to prescriptive regimes. After some thought, I have concluded that my initial reaction was the correct one, at least for me. I don't agree with the government choosing what we can and cannot wear, however repellent I may find the item or items of clothing in question. By all means, we should attempt to educate or persuade people to make better decisions, but my fear is that if the government gets to rule over one item of clothing that a large enough number of people find offensive, then they will not stop at the burqa. Whilst I think that wearing an item of clothing that covers the entire body from head to toe is a bizarre and nonsensical thing for a person to do, I don't believe that I or others should have the right to legislate against the right for an individual to do something that is bizarre and nonsensical, providing that it causes no direct harm to others. I find the concept of skydiving to be bizarre and nonsensical. Jumping out of an aeroplane and hurtling into the ground seems utterly unnecessary to me, but I accept that for some, this is something that makes them happy on some level, and that their decision to take their life into their own hands is their business, not mine. As far as I'm concerned, if you're an adult and of sound mind, you should have autonomy over what you think, do and say, what chemicals you put into your body, and ultimately, whether you live or die. More to the point, the right to do things that other people consider stupid should be protected, simply because we should not appoint an intellectual arbiter to take such decisions out of our hands. Like free speech, you either allow everything, including things that you dislike and consider potentially harmful, or you run the risk of letting the government choose what you can and cannot think or say. I don't want anyone to think that I'm overlooking the good that Namazi has done. She is a tireless and fearless advocate for human rights and has highlighted countless cases of abuse which would almost certainly have gone by unnoticed. But to come back to the burqa, I wonder, hypothetically, on what grounds the burqa should be banned. What about the claim that the burqa is a mobile prison, keeping women enslaved? The danger here is that, in the short term at least, you will turn a mobile prison into a stationary prison. Many Muslim women, if told that they will be arrested if they go out wearing the burqa, will simply choose to stay at home. It is not difficult to imagine that bad feeling and a sense of persecution will ferment within the Muslim community, further polarizing debate and contributing to the feeling of persecution that already exists, due in no small part to the focus upon the evils of Islam by the right-wing press. What about the claim that we need to ban the burqa due to security reasons? If this is the case, then we should also ban hoodies, snoods, hats, wigs, sunglasses, or any other item of clothing which obscures identification of an individual. Otherwise, we are showing that our claim to be motivated purely out of concerns for our security is disingenuous. Should it be banned because it is a religious symbol that some find offensive? If this is the case, then we should also be targeting the turbans of Sikhs, the crosses of Christians, the yarmulke of Jews, and those orange outfits worn by the Hare Krishna people. Obviously, all of these examples go against the principles of secularism, which are designed to protect the individual from religious persecution by the state. The decision to ban the burqa can only be justified if one decides that one religious symbol is less worthy of protection than another, and is willing to sacrifice one's secularist principles for the so-called greater good. And this is something that I cannot do in good conscience. I know that Namazi has gone to great lengths to distance herself from right-wing groups such as the EDL. Again, however, when your entire shtick is based around using examples of how abhorrent and backwards practitioners of one particular religion are, it is not difficult to see why hate groups would see you as an ally and use the examples you cite as a means of propaganda to support their aims. When your material can be quoted and used by far-right racist groups such as the EDL, perhaps, as Stuart Lee commented when Jim Davidson was accused of plagiarising Jimmy Carr's material, it's time to get some new material. In the long term, change will have to come from within Islamic societies if it's to come at all. Setting this up as a West versus Islam, us against them battle to the death is a recipe for failure, as anyone who understands the first thing about group dynamics already knows. There are vocal critics of traditional Islam within the worldwide Muslim community, and individuals such as Irshad Manji, who attempt to show that it is possible to be a progressive liberal Muslim female, stand a far greater chance of reaching those who want to experience the benefits of a secular society without having to reject their God. In terms of the long game, perhaps we need to take a more pragmatic stance and accept that, for most people at least, any movement away from a traditional patriarchal faith is going to occur slowly and not without internal and external resistance. I realise that I'm aligning myself with pragmatists like Julian Baghini, who Namazi singled out for criticism during her talk. But I believe that my pragmatism is based upon a strong premise. If the moderates are on side and see that we do not represent a threat to their way of life or their ability to pray to whichever god they choose, the fundamentalists and extremists become increasingly marginalised. So this is one reason why I see banning the burqa to be playing into the hands of the extremists. Yes, we should be opposing radical Islamists, but when we start targeting an entire community, we risk seeing more moderate members of that community becoming radicalised. I have no doubt there will be some people who accuse me of tone trolling or concern trolling or whatever you crazy kids call it these days. And some will be at pains to point out that an argument does not become invalid simply because of the way in which it's expressed. Whilst this is true, it ignores the fact that if you wish for your argument to be heard, considered, and to have the effect that you desire, which is, presumably, to convince someone else that they're wrong on an issue rather than simply being right, then tone and the manner in which an argument is presented is extremely important. A basic understanding of human psychology informs us that we are unlikely to persuade an individual of the erroneous nature of his or her beliefs if we begin by informing him or her that they are backward, twisted, anachronistic hangovers from a primitive past that are based around a centuries-old desire to keep women subservient, even if that is exactly the case. I would not couch my argument in those terms when attempting to persuade a believer to accept or understand my viewpoint, because said believer would stop listening before I'd even finish my sentence. I'm willing to adopt a more personable tone in an effort to get my point across, precisely because I care about the outcome of the conversation. I want to convince people that my argument has some validity, and in order to do that, they need to hear the argument, not be distracted by my tone. If this makes me a tone troll, then so be it. As far as I'm concerned, the end justifies the means. So, those are my long, and I appreciate, occasionally woolly thoughts. I don't claim to have all of the answers, but I'm happy to stick my head above the parapet over something as important as protecting the freedom of people to think and do things that others may think of as slightly or even extremely stupid. This has been Steve Page for The Pod Delusion.
And that's it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to over 2 years of archives and listen to loads of extra stuff on the Pod Delusion Extra feed. You can also follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook if you're into that sort of thing. Also this week, we're trying to get our listeners to fill in a Pod Delusion listeners survey, so if you enjoy the show, do head over to our website and tell us what you think and how we can improve. Also on our website, you can make a one-off donation or subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month. If you enjoy the show, then please put your money where your ears are and donate and support us to help doing the show week in, week out. All donations are greatly appreciated, and it's a bit like buying us a couple of drinks a month. You can find links to do so at poddelusion.co.uk. And don't forget, we've also partnered with Audible, the audiobook company, where if you sign up to Audible's free trial through our website, then you can download a free audiobook. That's right, for free. So that's quite a good incentive. So go to our website and click the links to do that. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Margaret McCartney, Adam Jacobs, Sean Ellis, Cash Farouk, Salim Fadley, James Robson, Steve Page, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The sketch in the moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Evening, chap. Usual, is it?
I'll say. I've been spitting feather since about 4:30.
What's that bird you eating again?
No. I just mean I'm thirsty. Now, is that pint ready yet?
Oh, yeah. Here you go.
Oh, now that looks nice. What the bloody hell? Are you trying to poison me? Well, what's this?
That, my friend, is the best petrol money can buy.
Petrol? Have you gone stark staring mad?
Have you not heard? They're going to be petrol tankers strike. And Francis Maud from the government, he said you got to top up and fill a couple of jerry cans. Well, we only had barrels standing idle.
You can't serve that in a pub.
Why not? It's more expensive than lager, and we're doing it at the same price. You're getting a bargain.
Is there anything else I should know?
Don't eat the hot pot.
You've been storing petrol in that too?
No. It's bloody horrible.
This is ridiculous. I'm not drinking that.
Well, you're the first person to complain. Davey's on his third pint, and he's had a couple of diesel chases.
No. Where is he then?
He's just popped out for a fag.
Dave?
Dave?